loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we'll talk about the Week in Review, including updates on the Syrian war and the deal on the status of Idlib, peace in Korea, and the U.S. campaign against Iran. We'll talk through what's been going on in all three areas of the globe. And then we take a look at political races across the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, a diplomatic standoff is heating up between Washington and Beijing over new U.S. sanctions on China. The Trump administration announced the sanctions because China agreed to purchase Russian jets and S-400 missiles. But China has bought Russian weapons for decades, and even the Trump White House admits that the new sanctions strategy for weapons purchases is unprecedented. Next, despite at least 16,000 deaths in Yemen, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has decided to continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia because he doesn't want to risk a weapons deal, according to a leaked classified memo. Meanwhile, the day that Pompeo certified that Saudi Arabia and the UAE were working to reduce casualties in Yemen, the coalition killed 27 civilians, almost all of whom were children. Then President Trump lashed out at Congress yesterday for not approving his long-promised border wall. But this time it's not just Democrats opposing it. Many Republicans, including several in the Republican leadership, say that the wall is impractical, unrealistic, and just too expensive. And then today, British Prime Minister Theresa May made strong comments about the Brexit process, saying that the EU's suggested alternative plan was, quote, unacceptable. We will never agree to it. It would mean breaking up our country, unquote. British and European Union leaders met yesterday in Salzburg to discuss the terms of the UK's withdrawal from the body, and things did not go well for May. The sticking point is what to do about the Irish border. May said that no deal on Brexit and the border is better than a bad deal, and that may be where negotiations are going. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, Vietnamese President Tran Đại Quang died today at the age of 61. Quang's death was attributed to, quote, a particularly virulent viral infection, unquote. Power is distributed in Vietnam's government between the country's president, prime minister, and the head of the Communist Party. Talks between India and Pakistan today were called off by the government of Indian Prime Minister Modi. Modi's administration cited the killing of three police officers in Kashmir, which he blamed on Pakistani support for rebels in the disputed province. There were hopes that relations between the two countries could improve with the election of new Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who has been launched into the national spotlight after alleging that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her, has opened the door to testifying next week. Initially, the testimony was scheduled for Monday without her consent, and she has asked for an investigation prior to the hearing. With resistance coming from Congress, she has now said that she will consider testimony, quote, on my own terms, unquote. Several anonymous sources have described Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's suggestion in the spring of 2017 that he secretly tape President Trump and his discussion of rallying administration officials to use the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from the presidency for being unfit. This discussion occurred when Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Rosenstein has disputed this account. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Week in Review. This week was filled with news, especially big developments in the war in Syria, the Moon Kim summit in North Korea, and the future of the Iran nuclear deal. We'll take a look at the week's most important developments. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He is a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Attack Iran. Welcome back, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with Idlib. It seemed like there's going to be this big offensive, possibly, you know, a false flag chemical attack, possibly another round of U.S. bombings targeting government installations. But it seems like we sort of stepped back from the brink this week. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one interesting thing is that Israel seemed to want to try to intervene, and that seems to have backfired on them, and now it seems like the U.S. and Israel don't know what to do. So, you know, there was the attempted bombing of the airport, which failed in Damascus, And, of course, a Russian plane was shot down. I guess Russia's blaming Israel for that. But, again, Russia did not react. And I think they will not be baited into a war.
It was pretty remarkable what happened. I mean, it was like this flurry of events, right? So, you know, first this sort of de-escalation deal in Idlib, even if it might be temporary, you know, that was signed. Israel carried out like the 202nd or whatever airstrike against a target inside of Syria. And then, you know, because it seems like this is what happened, Syrian air defenses responded to the Israeli attack. There were S-200 missiles that were shot at the Israeli jets. But because this is sort of the mystery, for some reason, there was a Russian plane in between the Syrian missiles and the Israeli jets that were bombing Syria. I think at first, right, they were saying that, well, the Israeli jets, they sort of flew behind the Russian plane. They're kind of using it as cover almost. But now it seems like people are trying to take down the temperature a little bit more. Maybe it was just a big mistake. Maybe it was, or, you know, a tragic mistake, a tragic miscommunication, something like that. Those are the formulations being used. What do you think? I mean, when Israel launched these strikes, do you think that they had the timing in mind that, you know, we want to make sure that the situation remains at this sort of pressure cooker boil?
Yeah, well, again, I do think that they were trying to look. I think the game plan, it appears to me, of the U.S. and Israel, frankly, is to keep this war going as long as they can. And I think that the attack on the airport was part of that. I mean, I think they don't want the final battle in Idlib to happen, and they don't want stability to come to Syria. So they're trying to do various things to prevent that.
You know, there's a historical precedent for that, too. I mean, that was for so many years. That was the policy between Iran and Iraq, where we wanted to keep them at war, fighting each other, because it was in U.S. interest to have a weak Iraq and a weak Iran, while Iraq could still protect the smaller Gulf states. You know, during the Bush administration, of course, that went out the window and Saddam Hussein was overthrown, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we've returned to that same kind of policy in Syria. The idea is just to keep everybody fighting and keep them weak.
Yes. Well, in fact, I read a very interesting article on Global Research website yesterday, basically arguing that that is the tack the U.S. is taking throughout the world. That is, you know, you can point to all these wars that the U.S. has been fighting where it can't be really claimed that the U.S. has won in any traditional sense. But it appears that the end game is to continue this eternal conflict, in part to continue to justify all these military expenditures. You saw, for example, I just read this morning that Mike Pompeo had overruled a number of folks who wanted to end the support for the Saudi genocidal war in Yemen, which is now putting at least 5 million children at risk of starvation. And there was a leaked memo showing that the reason he opposed any end to supporting the conflict was that $100 and some million was at stake in terms of arms sales to Saudi Arabia if we did that. And so, again, I think that, you know, war is good for business, and there are people who want to keep it going.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, if you... like, I don't think U.S. policymakers take into account whatsoever human lives or human suffering, right? So once sort of that's taken out of the equation, then I can totally see, and I think that argument is very plausible, that no solution is better than a bad solution for the United States, right? Like the continuation of war, the continuation of chaos, you know, the continuation of these humanitarian crises, like that's actually preferable than, say, you know, the Houthis consolidating control over all of Yemen, or, you know, the Syrian government being able to retake, you know, at least all of the territory west of the Euphrates River. You know, the war in Iraq kind of ended that way too, right? I mean, the United States certainly didn't win the Iraq war. I mean, the 2003 Iraq war. But it had such tremendous consequences for Iraqi society because of the way the U.S. occupation was organized that even today, you know, the deep sectarian divisions in society and politics and, you know, militarily, that's still being felt there. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely think that's a theme everywhere. Libya, right, is kind of like that too.
Yes. I mean, if you assume that the U.S. intends the consequences of its actions. And I guess, you know, you can't always assume that. And you look around at the chaos it continues to sow, you have to believe that it's part of the game plan.
It's unclear if this Idlib de-escalation deal, which involves the creation of this buffer zone, this sort of like demilitarized buffer zone, if that's going to be sort of like a permanent thing, like a thing that leads to a negotiated solution and sort of permanently staves off a final military battle for control of the province of Idlib, or if it's sort of a way, if it's a way to weaken the opposition by creating a or creating an obligation for the non-Al-Qaeda elements to turn against, you know, HTS, which is effectively the Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, inside of the province of Idlib. How do you see it? Do you think that this is sort of delaying the operation, or do you think that there's actually hope for some sort of negotiated withdrawal?
I think that is what Syria and Russia would like, is a negotiated withdrawal. I mean, Russia was very clear that it did not want massive bloodshed in Idlib, contrary to, of course, what the, you know, U.S. government and press tend to claim about Russia. They were very clear they didn't want to see a big bloodletting. So I think they'd like to find a different way to end the crisis.
A guest that we have on the show frequently, Peter Ford, he's the former U.K. ambassador to Syria. He wrote an article not too long ago and basically arguing that, you know, if the U.S., well, the last time that the United States launched a major bombing campaign in Syria, they were deciding between several options. The option that they ultimately went with is, you know, it was like a one day or like a one night cruise missile and bombing attack, right? That, you know, targeted several government installations, but wasn't sort of this like long term thing to perhaps destroy the Syrian Air Force or to like really militarily weaken like their ability to fight the war. But another option that they were considering is like a sustained bombing campaign, a bombing campaign that would prevent the Syria's ability to wage an air campaign against the opposition, that would try to, you know, kill top government and military leaders in these targeted airstrikes. And maybe, you know, maybe Russia looked at what was being prepared in terms of, you know, preparing public opinion for another quote unquote chemical weapons attack. That would, and in this case, right, this time around, Plan B, you know, the more extensive bombing campaign, that is what would be implemented. And so maybe Russia made the calculation, well, look, that's just too destabilizing. Like we have to back off at least momentarily. But that's not all that happened this week. There's big news out of Korea too. I mean, when I saw some of the photos that Moon and Kim were taking together, seeing the statements, I mean, it really struck me how much progress they had made, how sort of like warm just the personal relationship seemed to be. It was pretty amazing.
Yes, it is very heartwarming. Apparently, they have agreed to a de facto end of the Korean War, obviously long overdue, but it, you know, hadn't happened yet. Kim Jong-un seems to be a formidable leader. You know, I think when he first came on the scene, a lot of us wondered who this guy was. He seemed like a kid. We didn't know how responsible he was, but truthfully, he seems like a very responsible leader, and he seems to be very well received in South Korea. I think his polling numbers are through the roof there. So I'm very optimistic about what's happening in Korea.
Dan, I want to ask you about what's happening vis-a-vis North and South Korea, but here in Washington, it seems like every time the president makes a statement about the progress of things with North Korea, the opposite statement comes out of either the Pentagon or the NSC, and then something in the middle comes out of the State Department. Is it part of a sophisticated plan to keep North Korea off balance? Or do we really just have no coordinated policy on Korea right now?
I think we probably don't have a coordinated policy on Korea. I think that, you know, there are divisions about in the government about, you know, whether they really do want an end to the Korean War, whether they do really want to deal with Korea. I think there are people very afraid that peace might break out and that Kim Jong-un might get rid of his nuclear weapons because, again, North Korea's existence as a nuclear power is an excuse to continue military expenditures and military games in that region. And I think people there are people who don't want to see an end to that, but then I do think there are people ready to make peace. I mean, in honesty, I get the sense that Trump is one of the people who would like the feather in his cap of having helped to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. But I think there's a lot of people in his administration pushing back against that.
Right. I agree with you. I mean, I think that Donald Trump has very, very narrow, maybe purely electoral reasons for wanting this deal to succeed. The rest of his cabinet seems opposed to it. Pompeo, I mean, I think Pompeo wants to have a good relationship with Trump, and so he's sort of sincerely trying, and perhaps Pompeo cares more about the pressure campaign against Iran. But yeah, I agree. You know, I wanted to ask you about the media coverage, too, because it was presented sort of like very one-dimensionally, like the only thing at stake in these negotiations, in these high-profile summits, is North Korea's nuclear and missile program. Now, of course, that's a crucial issue, right? I mean, the North is going to have to give up a lot. They're going to have to give up this, you know, the nuclear deterrent that they've, you know, wanted for and, you know, maybe arguably needed for so many decades. But there's a lot more going on, too. I mean, Dan, don't you think it's kind of insulting that the corporate media in the West kind of neglects just the historic nature of the division of the Korean Peninsula and like the sincere desire of the people to see reunification?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is this ahistorical view that we're always given of practically everything, of the Vietnam War and certainly of the, you know, history of the Korean War and as you say, of the desire of the Koreans to become one country again. You know, they were one single country for centuries before the conflict. And yes, I think the media is very happy for people to forget about that. And again, it's such a joke, if you think about it, that there's this obsession about whether North Korea will keep its three or four nuclear warheads when the U.S. has thousands, you know? And again, that irony and that hypocrisy is rarely called out.
Yeah, or, you know, the 30,000 U.S. troops that are in South Korea. I mean, I think that's sort of the only thing that would really be enough of a concession to the North to get them to, you know, to dismantle whatever.
And it's crunch time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've both sides have said all the right things. Both sides have indicated publicly that they want to move forward. So now it's time to actually do something and to quantify this thing. So if the North Koreans are going to denuclearize, or at least partially denuclearize, the U.S. is going to have to come up with something, too, that's going to be acceptable to Pyongyang, not put Seoul in danger or not anger the South Koreans and make everybody happy. It's crunch time.
Yeah, well, it absolutely is. And again, I mean, the truth is these sanctions against North Korea are pretty devastating. I think they want to find a way out of those for sure. Yeah, so I agree. It is crunch time, and Moon wants a deal. You know, the U.S.'s partner in that region, South Korea, wants to end this conflict. So I think the U.S. is going to have a hard time stopping that.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of several books, including The Plot to Attack Iran. We're going over the biggest developments of the week. We were talking about Syria. We're talking about the big Moon Kim summit and peace in Korea right now. We're going to be getting to a couple other issues as well. But before we move on, Dan, I just wanted to ask you one last question about Korea. You know, the big talk right now is that, you know, Pompeo is maybe going to meet with the North Korean foreign minister, and that could possibly pave the way for a second summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump. Do you see that in the offing? Is that a realistic expectation that there'll be another big summit along the lines of what took place earlier this year in Singapore?
I do. I do believe that Trump wants part of his legacy to be a successful agreement with North Korea. So I think those summits are going to happen. Again, I think there's going to be people who are going to want to derail that. But I'm pretty optimistic it's going to happen.
So, Dan, you are the author of the book, The Plot to Attack Iran. You follow developments there pretty closely. And this was a pretty big week insofar as the future of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, these sanctions that the Trump administration very serious, severe, suffocating sanctions the Trump administration is trying to reimpose on Iran. What's your big takeaway from this week with regards to Iran?
Well, I continue to be worried that the U.S. is maneuvering towards some sort of conflict with Iran. It clearly is going to go ahead with these sanctions, and they're going to be very devastating for the Iranian people. I actually read an article that had an interview with the head of the Jewish hospital in Tehran, and he was saying that this is going to really hurt the most vulnerable in that country because they get about 40% of their raw material for medicine from abroad. And they get about 5% of medicines, actual medicines, from abroad. And the sanctions could really impact on that. And so, you know, it's a pretty scary situation. I think there is a lot of unrest in Iran right now because their economy is already feeling the heat from the sanctions that are already there and from the threatened sanctions.
Yeah, what's the quote about make the economy scream? I think it was something that Kissinger said to Nixon or Nixon said to Kissinger about Chile.
Yeah, well, Nixon said it. I actually was just reading about the Chilean coup, which happened 45 years ago, and it was Nixon who told the head of the CIA that he wanted to make the economy of Chile scream under Salvador Allende so that he could overthrow that government, which, of course, ultimately did happen. And yes, I think that is exactly the game plan with Iran, and by the way, of course, Venezuela as well, that they want to undermine the economy to such an extent that it'll weaken the governments in those countries.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Iran, it's presented as this sort of like monolithic totalitarian society where there's no, dissent. And, you know, of course, like all societies, there are like limits to what's being allowed, you know, what's allowed to be expressed, you know, in the mainstream. But there's actually like pretty intense internal political debate within the Iranian government, within Iranian society. I mean, earlier this year, we did see demonstrations break out. And then I think maybe it was about a year ago that sort of more serious protests against, I believe it was sort of like the rising cost of basic consumer goods broke out. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely possible. Do you think that, I mean, the U.S. would prefer something like that, right? Sort of like a color revolution along the lines of the so-called Green Movement in 2009. Like, that's actually preferable to them than a war, isn't it?
I don't know, because it's interesting that you mentioned the Green Movement in 2009. The U.S. helped to derail that, in fact, through more bellicose posture towards Iran. Every time they have a reformer come in, the U.S. is more apt to threaten Iran and sanction it, causing, not surprisingly, the hardliners to assert themselves in that country. So we have seemed not to want reform in that country, preferring, it seems, some sort of more drastic and complete regime change.
The United Nations General Assembly is coming up. Donald Trump is going to be speaking next week, and it's widely expected that he's going to focus his remarks on Iran and say, you know, very, very, very harsh things. I mean, the last time he gave an address to the UN General Assembly, he said that he would, I think, totally destroy, was the language, totally destroy North Korea if he needed to, so-called needed to. Maybe this is going to be sort of the Iran version of that type of rhetoric.
Yes, I would not be surprised. I think that, again, Iran is well within the sights of the Trump administration. The fact that John Bolton is the national security advisor certainly strongly suggests that. He's been very open about wanting regime change in Iran. So, yes, I think we can count on some sort of very aggressive talk against Iran in the General Assembly.
Let's talk about John Bolton for a second, too. You know, it's funny to me how so many of us, and not just us on the left, but so many Americans and so many in the mainstream media jumped up and down at the notion of John Bolton becoming the national security advisor. John Bolton's a very well-known, long-time neoconservative. He's never seen a war that he didn't want to jump into with both feet. He actively pushed the Bush administration to attack Iraq and indeed to attack Iran. And we don't talk about any of that anymore now that he's the national security advisor. It's as though the media is surprised that there are rumblings coming out of the White House that that we're pushing the Iranians and that there's the prospect of a war. We shouldn't at all be at all surprised because John Bolton is the national security advisor.
Yeah, and as you say, that seems to have been forgotten. But the problem also is that the press, you know, which has been good at holding Trump's feet to the fire on many issues, has not really gone after him in terms of foreign policy issues. You know, that the more bellicose he is, the more the press seems to like him. You know, the one time he was considered presidential was that first time that he bombed Syria after the alleged chemical attack. And so, yeah, if anything, they seem to be okay with his posture towards Iran. And again, if Hillary were president, frankly, it would be the same thing. She'd be just as bellicose and the press would be just as happy. So,
without a doubt,
there seems to be bipartisan support for that sort of thing.
You know, speaking of sort of officials with an axe to grind against Iran, I've been doing some research into this guy, Brian Hook, who's in charge of this new, you know, special team focusing on Iran, really focusing on isolating Iran from the international community. And when he was a Bush George W. Bush administration official, and he worked in the State Department on international organizations, right? And so John Bolton's role in the Bush administration, he was the ambassador to the United Nations. So I think this guy, Brian Hook, may have, you know, he sort of comes from the same like political milieu as Bolton. It's really a dangerous mix. Mattis, too, very anti-Iran, Pompeo. I think he tweeted right after he left Trump Tower for his sort of like interview to become Trump's CIA director, the position he held before he became Secretary of State. He tweeted about, you know, ripping up the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. So, yeah, lots of really dangerous constellation here. We've got about a minute left.
Yes, and both Bolton and Pompeo have addressed the Mujahideen of Iran, the MEK, has addressed their conferences. This is a very cultish terrorist group that's killed over 17,000 people within Iran. The fact that the people that are currently in the administration would have openly addressed their conference and talked about regime changes, Pompeo and Bolton have done, certainly have to be worrying to people.
Yeah, and Rudy Giuliani, I think, spoke at the MEK's big conference.
And he did, too. Yes, he did. And some Democrats as well. Howard Dean has been a big fan of the MEK as well.
Oh, yeah, I remember. That's super bizarre. But hey,
crazy.
Yeah, I guess they have money. I don't know. Well, anyway, we're about out of time. We've been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer. You can check out his book, The Plot to Attack Iran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host, Walter Smolarek. Again today, we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Good to have you back, Jackie.
Thanks for having me back.
Jackie, I'm a little bit biased, but I'm going to start with my favorite political race in the country again today, and that is the Texas Senate race between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke. Now, the reason I want to bring this up first is because there were three different polls that came out this week. Now, interestingly, a Quinnipiac poll, and Quinnipiac is usually very, very reliable, a Quinnipiac poll of likely voters shows Cruz winning this race and actually winning it kind of big by 9 percentage points, and that is 54 to 45. It's the first time that Cruz has been polling over 50%. Interestingly, it leaves only 1% undecided, which is very unusual in a race in which there's such a stark difference. Now, there was a second poll that came out. This is an MSNBC poll that shows Cruz losing to O'Rourke 47 to 45. That's within the margin of error, certainly. And then there's a third poll, this one by Ipsos, that also shows O'Rourke winning 47 to 45. Now, you and I have concluded many times over the last, couple of months, that this is one of those races that is just impossible to poll. It's that close. Ted Cruz is certainly not the most popular Republican in the nation or even in the state of Texas. Beto O'Rourke has hit literally every county in the entire state, and it doesn't matter if they are crimson red. He has gone and held town hall meetings. Tell me where you think this this race is finally heading.
This is one of the, you know, this is one of those races where you really have to watch it every day, and I think it's actually going to come down more to who's going to make the most missteps and voter turnout. And right now, with Ted Cruz's campaign efforts that have been really strange, I mean, the things that he's doing, that his campaign is doing to get contributions and to advertise his campaign and to, I guess, delegitimize his opponent are just clearly more and more desperate, which is not looking good for Ted Cruz. Like, the latest thing was the campaign mailer seeking contributions for all, you know, existing Republican donors that was presented as a summons.
Yes, it actually looked like a legal summons. It fooled a lot of people.
Yeah, it actually looked like a legal summons. I mean, I think the Texas Election Commission had to weigh in and say, well, you know, it wasn't illegal, but it really was misleading. So, I mean, that kind of stuff really looks desperate and cast a really negative light on what's supposed to be a seasoned political campaign. So I think that's going to play a part in just framing who Ted Cruz is, but then we cannot dismiss voter turnout. And like we always say every week, Republican voters are just committed to turning out every single election. They will vote, you know, in mass for dog catcher. So I this really is one of those things where I'm going to have to be looking at the results, like on the day of the midterm, to see how it's going to shake out, because right now we really don't know.
Well, you know, I read a fascinating statistic too, and it said that in Texas in the 2016 election, 1 in 8 voters, that's a lot, 1 in 8 voters made up their mind who to vote for in the 3 days before the election.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this is going.
Yes, which, you know, thankfully, I think Texas is not one of those states that does a lot of early voting. That's become more popular of late, but Texas is not one of those states. And Texas, with this particular race, I think voters can't possibly. I think voters are actually going to be standing in line weighing, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And a lot of those voters are going to be Republicans. I'm not worried about, and neither is Beto O'Rourke, which is why he campaigned in every single district. He's not worried about who would likely vote Democrat. He's worried about people who are undecided, that 1% of undecided, and the Republicans.
It's all about turnout. One other thing that I was really interested to read, O'Rourke has raised just in the last quarter, O'Rourke raised $23.6 million, which is more than any other Senate candidate in America of either party. $23.6 million. He raised another $10.4 million in May. That's twice what he raised in the previous quarter. And John Cornyn, the number two Republican in the Senate, who's the senior senator from Texas, told Politico, and this is a quote, he's talking about the Cruz race, this is real and this is a serious threat.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think, yeah, Texas is a big state and there's a lot of money in Texas, but I also think the ability for of O'Rourke to raise that kind of money in such a short period of time speaks to to the rise in his national profile and how serious people are taking this man's campaign and his candidacy for this office around the country. Texas is a national race for the Democrats and the Republicans. It just is. And on that note, the Democrats are winning.
They are. They are indeed. Politico had another article this past week that was, I think, very important. Now, they started off with the Beto O'Rourke-Ted Cruz race, and this was the five the five races that could tip the Senate. I disagree with some of these, but they made a good point. And so what I want to raise with you is Royal Blue, New Jersey. Politico is saying that if the Democrats lose Bob Menendez's New Jersey Senate seat, that's it. They lose the Senate. Now, it never even occurred to me that Menendez might be in trouble, but thinking about it a little, I suppose he could be. Menendez was charged with multiple felony counts related to official corruption. He pleaded not guilty. He went on trial. It was a hung jury, and the Justice Department announced that they would not retry him. So he claims that he's been vindicated. He actually hasn't been vindicated. It's just that he wasn't found guilty. And the latest poll has him leading a no-name Republican, a guy who used to be the CEO of a pharmaceutical company, by only 6 percentage points. Should the Democrats be worried about Bob Menendez?
Unless his Republican opponent can really capitalize on the dismissed court case or the hung jury, which he isn't, I don't think so. I really don't think that Menendez's legal issues is going to keep him from winning this seat. I mean, stranger things have happened, but I don't think the Democrats have to worry about losing. I do think they have to worry, though. What I do think they have to worry about, though, John, is the lack of a real message that has given Menendez only a 6-point lead some guy that just decided to run.
Good point. You know, the Democrats are saying that they're hopeful because Menendez always seems to pull away at the end of the race, and he hasn't yet begun running negative ads against this guy, Huber, who used to be the CEO of Celgene. But at the same time, Huber's a billionaire, and he's using his own money to finance this race, and he has just been beating up on Menendez in television ads. So I agree with you. I think Menendez is going to win, but I think it's going to be close, and I think the reason it'll be close is because you're right. He really doesn't have a message. He doesn't really stand for much except for, you know, hating Cuba. And he hasn't explained these corruption charges, at least not adequately. Well, let's move on. Let's move on to Tennessee. You and I have been talking about Tennessee for several months now. And this is the race between Marsha Blackburn, the Republican congresswoman, and Phil Bredesen, the former Democratic governor. Bredesen is by far the most popular politician in the state. Likely voters favor him 55 to 26 in terms of who do you trust. But Blackburn's also very popular. 45% have a favorable opinion of her. 43% have an unfavorable opinion of her, which to me argues for a close contest. But regardless of Bredesen's popularity, for whatever reason, the latest polls show him losing to Blackburn by 3 percentage points. Now, national Democrats are saying, no way. They're saying that the polls are skewed, but we have to remember that Tennessee is a state that elected Donald Trump by 26 percentage points. So my question to you then, Jackie, is does Donald Trump have coattails in Tennessee, or is Phil Bredesen, based on his own popularity and his very successful 8 years as governor, going to pull this race out?
This is one of those races where the Trump factor could swing things. And the interesting thing to me about this race is that, you know, Marsha Blackburn is willing to kind of back some of Trump's policies. She hasn't been really openly, you know, harshly critical of him. And she can't because of the support Trump has in Tennessee. Bredesen was popular back then, right? And I don't see him being able to capitalize on that popularity now and overcome the pro-Trump sentiments in this state. I think his lead is too small.
I think you might be right. And a lot of Republicans in Tennessee are saying, yeah, we love Phil Bredesen, but if we vote for him, that could flip the Senate to the Democrats, and that defeats the whole purpose of supporting Donald Trump.
I don't think Bredesen's going to win this one.
Let's move over to Minnesota. And this is a race that nobody is talking about.
Yeah.
Al Franken resigned from his Senate seat because he got caught up in the Me Too movement. And the governor named really an unknown to fill his Senate seat. That was the Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith. Now, Tina Smith initially said she didn't want to run for the Senate. She changed her mind and decided to finish out the term, or to try to finish out the term at least. She faces an even less well-known Republican in State Senator Karen Housley. Now, Housley has kind of made a race of this. There are a lot of undecided voters, but the latest polls, and this is the Minneapolis Star Tribune and the Minnesota Public Radio poll, shows Smith winning 44 to 36. Now, the magic number, of course, is 50% in any poll. So this is a lieutenant governor. You would figure everybody in the state would know who the lieutenant governor is. Polling at only 44%, the Republicans could actually win this race. Again, Minnesota is usually a blue state, but Donald Trump lost Minnesota by only 1.5 percentage points. What's going on here?
Voter disenfranchisement with a party without policies that they are actually able to campaign and stake a moral claim on against a president and an opposing party that is pretty much morally bankrupt, but is showing to be a political force to be reckoned with. That, I mean, how do you have, like you said, a lieutenant governor who isn't even able to garner 50% support in the polls? That's a bad sign.
In a Democratic state.
I mean, but when you have a presidential candidate in the embodiment of somebody as horrible as Donald Trump, well, a president now, as horrible as Donald Trump, who lost in a blue state by 1%, you can't really call that a blue state anymore.
Agreed. I want to move over to Arizona briefly. This is yet another race that you and I have talked about a lot. I hope people aren't tired of hearing about it.
I am not tired of looking at it.
But what we have is a race as close as a race can get. We've got both the Republican and the Democrat polling 47-47 in the race to succeed Senator Jeff Flake, a conservative Republican. This is one of those races that everybody is looking at that could determine control of the Senate. Has anything changed over the last week or two?
I don't know that anything's changed. It's still a neck and neck horse race, really, where you're looking at, interestingly, one of the few races where voters are having to choose between two women. And that's a great thing, but it's also, I guess, a litmus test on, look, what kind of woman-led policies are the voters in Arizona going to vote for? Are they going to vote for typical GOP policies that are presented just with the face of a woman? Or are they going to vote for woman-friendly policies presented by Kristen Sinema? And it's not because of the nature of Nevada, where Trump squeaked out a close win in 2016. He didn't win by an enormous amount. It's not a surprise that this race is as close as it is. And I think this is another one of those races where we're going to be watching the day of the midterms, and I don't know that I'm going to be surprised by either result, whichever way it goes. It's a really interesting election season in this midterms. It's very fascinating.
Oh, I agree. Hey, I want to talk about a more obscure race for a couple of minutes too, Jackie. Do you remember Donna Shalala? Donna Shalala was the Secretary of Health and Human Services during the Bill Clinton administration. By all accounts, she was very popular. When Clinton moved on and finished his term, Shalala became a university president. Well, 2 years ago, Democrats talked her into running for Congress. And it's a very heavily Hispanic, but heavily Democratic district. It's the 27th congressional district. 2 years ago, she ran and she won by 20 percentage points, 60 to 40. She was well-known, former cabinet secretary, and she has a real talent for raising money. She was a natural. But the Miami Herald says that now local Democrats are in a state of dismay as Shalala is struggling to put away her Republican rival, a popular former Spanish-language television newswoman named Maria Elvira Salazar. According to internal polls from both campaigns obtained by Politico, Salazar is either ahead or barely trailing Shalala. It says here, Salazar leads the former Clinton Foundation head by 7 percentage points in a poll conducted for the Republicans' campaign that was completed on Thursday, and in a poll from Shalala's campaign completed 3 weeks ago, the Democrat led Salazar by only 4 percentage points. Either way, the race is too close to call for Democrats. It looks like Donna Shalala may be losing this race. Now, why would Donna Shalala lose? Democrats say that she's just mailing this election in. She figured she is so popular, and by God, she's Donna Shalala, that this is going to be a coronation rather than election. In fact, it's not a coronation, and she could lose it.
Yeah, yeah. That seems to be a problem with the Democrats in Florida probably in a few other states. But another issue with this race that Donna Shalala is in and is losing surprisingly badly is her age.
Mm-hmm. She's 77 years old.
Yes, and voters, especially younger voters, are tired of the old guard. I don't mean that to be a bad pun. That really is. People are looking at these career politicians who have been in office for 20, 30 years, and they're saying there's got to be somebody with not even fresh and new ideas, because the policies that younger voters are looking for aren't really new ideas. They just are looking for politicians who are not willing to continue to toe the establishment party line of centrism and neoliberalism. They're looking for politicians who are willing to stand up for the people. And the Donna Shalalas and honestly the Bill Nelsons of the Democratic Party and the Dianne Feinsteins, that's not them.
Mm-hmm.
This is why these people, aside from their phoning it in and believing that, almost looking as if they believe they have a right to win their elections, this is also why people are not excited about voting for them, and why Shalala will probably lose. And the way it looks now, so will Bill Nelson.
Well, I have to agree with you. And I think there's another reason why Donna Shalala is going to lose this race. This district is a 57% majority Hispanic district. Most of those Hispanics are Cuban Americans like Salazar. Donna Shalala doesn't speak Spanish.
Oh, what a nightmare.
In a 57% Hispanic district, she doesn't speak Spanish. Of course, Salazar speaks fluent Spanish. She was a Spanish language news broadcaster. And the latest poll in Politico says that most of the new arrivals are from Venezuela, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Peru, and they tend to be more conservative than the young Cubans. The old Cubans, of course, are very conservative. But what Salazar is doing to really try to put this away is she's giving most of her interviews in Spanish. And there's a poll conducted by McLaughlin Associates says that Salazar is leading Shalala among Spanish speakers 70-15, while Shalala is leading Salazar among English speakers only 52-30. I don't see how Shalala wins this race.
She doesn't win this race. She really doesn't. I mean, you can't convince people to vote for you if you cannot communicate with them why they should vote for you. That's pretty common sense logic that I wish the Democrats had focused their attention, their money, their efforts on a more viable candidate. Mm-hmm. They would have been better backing a no name somewhere down the line than going with Donna Shalala. It's not going to end well for them.
You know, one other footnote here is, even though Shalala was an incumbent, a one-term incumbent, 5 other Democrats ran against her in the primary, and she was weakened in that primary because those 5 incumbents spent $1 million on negative TV ads attacking Shalala for being ineffectual. So yeah, I think she's got a very tough time. I don't see how she wins this race. I'm going to go back to Real Clear Politics. I usually end the segment with the latest polls, but there were some that are really interesting to me that I wanted to go over. In that some that aren't supposed to be close are close, and others that were supposed to be close, we're seeing one member or one party member or the other pulling away. the Michigan Senate race, which in the beginning, a lot of pundits thought was going to be close, shows Debbie Stabenow, the incumbent Democrat, winning by 13 percentage points. The Rhode Island Senate race shows Senator Whitehouse, the incumbent senator, winning by 19 percentage points. The Democrats are shown winning the Rhode Island governor's race by 7 percentage points. Pennsylvania governor, Governor Wolf, is winning by 12 percentage points. We see Ben Cardin in Maryland winning by 39 percentage points. Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts winning by 30 percentage points, 65 to 35. And then we have the generic races. We've got Democrats winning by 9, by 5, by 7, by 12, by 8. That's bumping right up against that so-called wave number that the Democrats need to win back control of the House. Other races that might have been close that no longer are close. In Virginia, we have Tim Kaine beating Corey Stewart by 16 percentage points, 52 to 36. Of course, Stewart is the Tea Party candidate who wasn't supposed to win the Republican primary, but ended up winning it anyway. In Arizona, we have Sinema over McSally by 7 percentage points. We have now Bredesen, this is a CNN poll, winning by 5 percentage points. Joe Manchin in West Virginia, we've talked about him a lot, is pulling away and winning by 12 percentage points. So the people who were supposed to win are winning. The people who were slightly leading, it seems, are starting to pull away. Interesting, and you raised this a few minutes ago, we're not seeing any polls coming out of that Florida Senate race. Now, in the gubernatorial race, Congressman DeSantis versus Andrew Gillum, who won in an upset, he's a local mayor, I think he's the mayor of Jacksonville, they show Gillum winning by 6 percentage points. That would be a big deal. Now, is 6 percentage points enough to bring Bill Nelson back into the Senate, or is Bill Nelson going to lose that race?
I think Bill Nelson is going to lose this race, and what happened this week is, I think, is actually why. Rick Scott went to Puerto Rico this week to commemorate the anniversary of Hurricane Maria, and Scott's been back and forth to PR for, you know, quite a bit since the hurricane. Bill Nelson chose to stay in Miami, and during a press conference, Nelson said that, you know, he didn't want to talk politics. He didn't want to talk about the actual death toll numbers. He questioned why Rick Scott went to Puerto Rico, but he also said, Bill Nelson also said that he would not go to Puerto Rico before the election. I think that is just a disastrous campaign move, strategically, that's disastrous. It feels to me like he's literally just standing there saying, I really don't even care. So I think he's going to lose this race, and I think he just lost it this week.
You know, I have to agree, because you've got 27,000 Puerto Ricans who left the island after Hurricane Maria and settled in Florida. And they're American citizens. They're registered to vote now in Florida. So why in the world would you say that you are not going to go to Puerto Rico? You're not going to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the hurricane. And you really have done nothing in the United States Senate to try to increase aid to Puerto Ricans affected by the storm. That makes no sense at all.
None whatsoever. But just to go back to the Gillum DeSantis race, that actually, I think, is going to be another one of those races, or it's shaping up to be another one of those races where the bad campaign tactics of the Republicans is going to be what helps the Democrat win even bigger, because DeSantis's continued problems with aligning himself with racists continues to dog him. Voters can't ignore this anymore. There's a serious problem with the kinds of people this man, and not just him, but his wife and others in his campaign have aligned themselves with. They've spoken at events that have been hosted by white supremacists and John Birch Society types, and it's all coming out now, and he can't get away from it, and that only boosts Andrew Gillum in the polls. So that 6%, I'm expecting that to grow.
Agreed. Jackie, we have less than 1 minute left. I would like to highlight to our listeners a piece that appeared in 538.com, one of the foremost political sites that exists. These folks at 538 really get down into the weeds, the numbers, the science of politics. Now, they have a proprietary algorithm that makes these determinations, but what they're talking about here is fundamentals of each individual race. Now, when the computer analyzes the fundamentals and expected turnout in each race, they show the Democrats winning back the House of Representatives. The chances are 80.4% to the Republicans maintaining control, 19.6%. I think that's actually rather dramatic. In the Senate, we're looking at essentially a 50-50 probability of the Republicans retaining control or the Democrats winning control. It's going to come down to turnout, like you and I have been talking about. There's no two ways about it. But we're going to have to end it there. We were joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.